You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New York Times Magazine devoted its entire issue this past Sunday to Scott Anderson's 18-month investigation into the complicated situation in the Middle East, in which at least three countries, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, have disintegrated so completely as to raise doubts that they will ever exist again as fully functioning states. This didn't happen overnight, and while the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a flashpoint for the region, the history of European intervention following World War I created conditions that may have made the current internal warfare almost inevitable. 10 portfolios by the photographer Paolo Pellegrin accompany the story, as well as a virtual reality experience. I'm very pleased that Scott Anderson's article, Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart, has brought him back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
How long did this take you to put together? This is almost like writing a book.
Yeah, it's kind of a small book.
And you have written a book about the region.
Yes, it was about 18 months, all told. It was four long trips to the region, each one about a month to 6 weeks, and then writing up as I went along.
Didn't you first travel with your father to the Middle East as a young boy in the early 1970s?
Yes. My father, in hindsight, I realized he was having a midlife crisis, which I was aware of at the time, but he took me out of school for a year. I didn't go to ninth grade, and we had a VW camper, and we drove from France to India and back.
And that got you interested in the region as something that you would focus on during your career?
I can't say that. I was quite young, but I had never been in the desert before. I had never been in the Arab world. And I was immediately enraptured by it and fascinated by it.
And Islam?
And Islam, yeah. I don't come from a religious family. And just seeing the fervor of the Islamic religion, it was something very exotic to me.
Your first foray into journalism was in Beirut.
Right.
But Beirut is an atypical city in the region.
Very much so, yeah. The most cosmopolitan city.
Is it still?
It is. Yes, it is. Beirut is just a place unto itself. It's a true melting pot. I went there in 1983 when the American Marines were there. I was trying to break into journalism, and I arrived just before the Marine barracks was blown up. And it actually unsuccessful. That my first foray into journalism was it was very expensive, and I just ran out of money before I could land a job.
Oh, you weren't working for anyone?
No, I was just trying to string.
But over the course of your career, you've embedded with a platoon of Israeli commandos conducting raids in the West Bank. You've dined with Janjaweed raiders in Darfur, the bad guys.
Right.
Interviewed the families of suicide bombers. That covers a wide range.
Yeah. I've really been going to the Middle East for probably the last 20, 25 years. So
the reason I mention that is we tend to think of the Middle East as a kind of a place.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what we're talking about here is a lot of different places, even in a fairly small area.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a fantastic mosaic of peoples and cultures.
In the Times article, you argue that factors dating back to the post-World War I breakup of the Ottoman Empire have to be understood in order to make sense of the current conflicts. How did carving up the Ottoman Empire lead to the present situation?
I don't know if you can draw a direct line to it, but it certainly was an enormous contributing factor. What happened at the end of World War I, Britain and France, the victors, they looked at the Ottoman Empire as the spoils of war. And they actually called it the Great Loot. And so they carved up the Ottoman Empire between themselves. And in Iraq, the British created Iraq out of three largely autonomous regions that had existed under the Ottomans. In Syria, they did just the opposite. Greater Syria was this vast area, and instead they turned Greater Syria into four smaller nations that they controlled. Libya was slightly different. That was controlled by the Italians, and they joined three ancient kingdoms together to create Libya.
When he was running for president in 2004, Joe Biden was criticized for suggesting that Iraq should be divided into three separate states reflecting religious and cultural differences, Shiite, Sunni, and Kurd. Would that have prevented some of the problems that we've seen there since?
It may have. It may have. I mean, Kurdistan today, Iraqi Kurdistan, really is its own country in all but name.
And one of your articles here deals with that.
That's right. And really, since 1992, it has had very little involvement with the rest of Iraq. So it's tempting to think that what you could create in the rest of Iraq between the Shia and the Sunni is instead of a bifurcated country that you have now, create a trifurcated one. The problem is that these lines are not just as simple kind of sectarian lines. First of all, there's been tremendous mixing over the over the decades. There's also a whole tribal element to the issue, and some of the larger tribes in Iraq have both Sunni and Shia components. So, where does that tribe go? When you start thinking of dividing the region, it's tempting to think that's the solution. The divisions just continue on and on and on.
We've seen similar situations in the breakup of Yugoslavia,
right,
where there was intermarriage between different groups, and suddenly you had to either be a Serb, a Croat,
exactly,
a Slovene, a Montenegrin.
That's right.
A Kosovar.
Right. There are actually a lot of similarities, I think, between the former Yugoslavia and what you're seeing happening now in Syria and Iraq.
My guest is Scott Anderson. He is responsible for the Complete Sunday Times magazine of last week. This follows his work as a war correspondent, a novelist, and he's also a frequent contributor to the New York Times magazine, GQ, Esquire, Men's Journal, and Vanity Fair. You talked to six different people. Of the six that you profiled, all but one, you say, is from one of the newly created states.
Right.
And the situation today, you write, is rooted in how those nations came to be.
Yeah, I think that to really understand what's happening in the Middle East, and I think for most people it's quite confusing. I mean, it's quite confusing to me at times too. But if you look at the three states that are truly failed, Iraq, Libya, Syria, what they all have in common is that they were these amalgams put together at the end of World War I. But more significantly, the sense of national allegiance, the sense of national identity, is skin deep in a lot of those places. And that was something that the dictators, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, Hafez al-Assad, were very much trying to do in their own brutalistic way, is to create sort of a national identity. So when the dictators are overthrown, what takes their place? You have no consensus of what takes the place, and people tend to fall back on their tribal or sectarian allegiances.
But this is the situation that occurred everywhere there was colonialism. We see it all throughout Africa. We see it with the partition of India and Pakistan and then the creation of Bangladesh. We see it with the turmoil in Sudan right now. In fact, in many cases, you have to blame the British for most of the problems of the world.
They just drew these arbitrary
lines and said, okay, this is Nigeria, this is Ghana.
That's right. And what the British also did, and the French did also, is they often empowered a local, either religious or tribal minority, to serve as their local overseers, knowing that that indigenous minority could never rebel against the colonial power because they would be overwhelmed by the majority. So it was very much a divide-and-conquer system they used.
Your articles cover the history of the region, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and the Arab Spring. Were you hopeful when the Arab Spring began?
I was enormously hopeful.
What did you think was going to happen?
You know, I mean, having traveled all around the world, I've never the political stagnation I've always felt in the Arab world. I don't know of any other region of the world to kind of compare it to. And so when the Arab Spring started, I was very hopeful that finally, the street, as they call it, the people in the street were finally channeling their anger and their rage where it always had belonged, which was at their dictators. And so initially, especially when Egypt happened, when Tahrir Square and Mubarak was overthrown, it seemed there was this moment where there was this chance for democracy and representative government.
But it does come as a surprise that a suicide by a poor Tunisian, Mohamed Bouazizi, would start this whole thing. There have been other protests in the past. People have been thrown in jail. They've been tortured. They've been killed. Right. And nothing has happened. Why do you think that sparked it?
Well, it's the mysterious way history works. How can something that is just completely unforeseen trigger this thing? I do think, though, you really have to go back to the American invasion of Iraq. I mean, I think that was the event.
The toppling of Saddam Hussein.
That changed the political chessboard throughout the region. And so for the first time, you saw one of these dictators had been around for 25, 30 years. He was toppled, and it completely changed the complexion throughout the world. And all of a sudden, it was like, well, maybe the Saad dynasty can be overthrown. Gaddafi was in for 42 years. You know, so it opened up this realm of what was possible in the region. And one other thing I was going to add is social media. Yeah, when Tunisia blew up, it was instantly known throughout the rest of the Arab world. I mean, through Twitter and YouTube, you know, with the exception of North Korea, you can't bottle information up in the world anymore.
But the overthrow of Saddam Hussein also unleashed terrorism across the region. He was blamed for terrorism, which he probably should have been blamed for, but that's a whole other issue. And hadn't Muammar al-Gaddafi predicted it to you in an interview?
Yes. I interviewed Gaddafi in October of 2002, and this was just during the drumbeat for war against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And I asked Gaddafi, so what's going to happen? What do you think will happen if who's going to benefit if the Americans invade Iraq? And Gaddafi had this habit of sort of theatrically pausing for a long time before answering my questions. And in that, he was instantaneous. He said, Osama bin Laden, he's going to benefit. Because if the Americans go into Iraq, it's going to give a resurgence to al-Qaeda, and you're going to see a jihad against the United States.
It's interesting that we still see confusion in this country as to how all of those things developed. And there's been that big brouhaha over the suggestion from Donald Trump and people who work for him that Barack Obama created ISIS and Hillary Clinton was the co-founder.
Right. Yes, I know.
And one of Pearson, one of Trump's people, said that Barack Obama invaded Afghanistan.
Right, when he was a state legislator in Illinois. You know, this has been a talking point of the genesis, I think, of this with Trump. It's been a Republican talking point for the past couple of years that by withdrawing American troops out of Iraq, which happened in 2011, it created this vacuum in which ISIS and al-Qaeda moved in. What's forgotten in that is that troop withdrawal was actually ratified under the Bush administration. It was in the summer of 2008. They were unable to come to an agreement with the Maliki regime in Iraq that would allow American troops to stay. So even that predated Obama's presidency.
So that was an agreement, and Obama was just following the terms of the agreement.
Right. That's right.
But ISIS also could be said to have started during the Bush presidency because its founder was in prison with a bunch of people in Iraq at the time.
That's right.
And they pretty much came up with the idea there.
Right. And what the genesis of ISIS is a very complicated one, and it came out of al-Qaeda of Iraq. Ba'athist elements came in that had kind of taking a religious component and politicizing it more. It's very hard to really pinpoint.
Could you talk a bit about the Ba'ath Party? Because we have the Ba'ath Party in Syria and the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, and the only thing that they seem to have in common is that they're named Ba'ath Party.
Right. The Ba'athist Party was a kind of a quasi-socialist movement that started in the 1940s. Very much about pan-Arabism,
and a lot of Christians involved,
and a lot of Christians. And the one interesting parallel, and there's, you know, the horrible irony of the American invasion of Iraq. What the one commonality you had between the Ba'athist regimes in Syria and Iraq, and with Gaddafi's regime in Libya, was that their greatest threat and who they hunted down ruthlessly were Islamic fundamentalists. So the notion that we were seeing in 2002, 2003, that somehow Iraq was this safe haven for al-Qaeda, and really nothing could have been more ludicrous. And so all those regimes throughout the decades, that was, and frankly within in Egypt also, they were all very much targeting Islamic fundamentalism. They always saw that as the greatest threat to their rule.
Can we say that Saddam Hussein inspired Gaddafi. Gaddafi originally would have been inspired by Nasser. Of Egypt, but then Hussein gave him a different way of thinking about how to rule.
I think with Gaddafi he's kind of just an odd separate case. I mean, I think he was very heavily influenced by Nasser of Egypt, who had come to power in 1952.
Well, he was the hero of pretty much all of the
Arab world. Yeah, he really was. And yes, it was a military dictatorship in Egypt, but it was a much softer one than the Ba'athist regimes or Gaddafi's regime in Libya.
My guest is Scott Anderson. His article, Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart, was the whole Sunday Times Magazine last Sunday. We will continue our conversation, talk about some of the people that he's profiled after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Scott Anderson, whose series of articles under the title Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart, was the complete New York Times Sunday Magazine, except for the crossword puzzle and a few other things last Sunday. Let's talk about some of the people you profiled. Laila Souef is featured in part one, 1972-2003. She was just 16 when she attended her first political rally?
Yes.
What was she protesting?
She was a leftist high school student, actually, at the time, in 1972. And she was protesting to try to get Anwar Sadat to go to war against Israel to reclaim the Sinai Peninsula that Israel had seized in 1967. She and her husband became probably the only people at all known that I profile in the story. Her husband, Ahmed Saif, was a human rights lawyer. He just died 2 years ago. But probably the most famous political dissident couple in Egypt, protested against the Sadat regime and against Hosni Mubarak, was in the front lines of the Tahrir Square demonstrations.
They protested Sadat because he made a deal with Israel.
Right.
And it is generally assumed that he was assassinated because of that deal?
Absolutely, yeah. He was assassinated by a group of Islamist military plotters.
So were they opposed to Mubarak because he was oppressive or because he also had a detente with Israel?
Both. And I think also with Mubarak, what you had was just extraordinary corruption. All the wealth of the country was going into the hands of a few politicians and a few generals. But the thing that I found really fascinating about Egypt, I spent a lot of time in Egypt in 2006, and at the time I thought that Mubarak's regime was in serious danger of being overthrown. And that was at a time, of course, when Egypt was seen as America's most reliable Arab world ally. And over scores of interviews I did, I've still never found an Egyptian yet who supported the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, or ever saw the subsidies that were coming from America to the Mubarak regime as anything other than a source of national shame. So what you had at this time when the United States really saw Egypt very benevolently under Mubarak was the seething rage in the country directed at the regime. And this sense of national disgrace that they had become America's lapdog.
But also, they lost a couple of wars.
That's very true, yeah. But although that's kind of interesting, too, because the 1973 war, which the Egyptians started, of course, it somehow painted as a victory in Egypt, because in the first couple of days, they caught the Israelis off guard, and they actually made advances. And so this is seen as a great victory. They sort of forget the last part of that war when that same Egyptian army got surrounded.
But Laila Souef and her husband really didn't achieve anything, did they?
You know, she's a remarkable woman. She's actually a mathematics professor at Cairo University, and they had three children who are now all in their late 20s, early 30s. Two of whom are now in prison under the Sisi regime. So she was very much in the front lines of the Tahrir Square uprising, and she felt that there was this crucial moment. Right when Mubarak was about to be overthrown, that the the political parties need to step forward and seize power. They could not let the military sort of exert its control. And she just couldn't, and she was lobbying, even the Muslim Brotherhood, saying, just grab power. Don't let the military co-opt this thing. And no one did anything. And so the military did co-opt it. You finally had democratic elections 1 year later, in which Mohamed Morsi, a Muslim Brotherhood, became the first democratically elected president of Egypt.
To the regret of many people.
But also already undermined by the Egyptian military. They had sort of set him up to fail. And so a year on, he was overthrown.
The next person you profiled is it Mahdi or Majdi?
Majdi.
Majdi de Mangush, somebody born on July 4th.
Yeah, Majdi has an amazing story. He was Libyan. He was an Air Force cadet in Gaddafi's military. When the revolution started in February of 2011 in Libya, he was quarantined. He and his fellow Air Force cadets were quarantined on a military compound. So for 3 months, while the civil war went on, he had no idea of what was going on. And all of the information he got was that, oh, it's foreign hired mercenaries attacking Libya. It's criminal elements. So he volunteered. His hometown of Misrata was one of the centers of the revolution. So he volunteered to go back into his hometown as a spy for the Gaddafi government, and to locate who the rebel leaders were so they could be assassinated. He crosses through no man's land. He goes back to Misrata, and he discovers that it's not foreign mercenaries. In fact, it's his own family. His own immediate family are rebels. So he does this amazing kind of sting to get loose of his handlers for the regime, and then he joins the revolution.
And Libya has been a bit of a disaster.
It has been a disaster.
Because so many different people came in to fight for or against Gaddafi?
It really goes back to, well, the one huge mistake that was made is when Gaddafi was overthrown, the kind of very fragile coalition central government said that everybody who had fought against Gaddafi would get compensation. And so by generous estimate, there were probably about 20,000 actual rebels who had fought against the Gaddafi regime. All of a sudden, 250,000 people claimed to be fought, and they all got money from the central government. And so, what ended up happening very, very quickly was that people had a vested interest in forming militias and dividing up the country, and they were getting checks from the central government to do so. So, it was an absolute recipe for the Balkanization of the country.
My guest is Scott Anderson. We're talking about the Middle East, I guess post-breakup of the Ottoman Empire, but also post-Arab Spring. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The rulers of Iraq, Syria, and Libya knew that their states were artificially constructed and that their people identified more by tribe and religion than by nation, but they used that to their advantage.
Oh, absolutely they did. There was very much, and so let's just use the example of Syria. Syria, ruled by a religious minority, the Alawites, which is a kind of a branch of Shia, in a overwhelmingly Sunni majority country. The Alawites, the Assad father and son, had an alliance with, and still have an alliance, with the Christian minority. So now you put together the Alawites and the Christians, and you have a workable minority if you have all the guns and all the money, about 14-15% of the country, maybe even 18%. So yeah, absolutely, these alliances occurred in all these countries.
The Assads were also presenting themselves as the bulwarks against religious fundamentalism.
That's right. And the father
we Hafez have to al- prevent the Sunnis from taking over.
Exactly, and that's what's, you see that playing out today too. When the Arab Spring started in Syria, there were people counseling Assad, Bashar al-Assad, the son. Look what's happened in Libya. Look what's happened in Egypt. Forge a compromise here. But for the Alawites and to a large degree the Christians also, they saw any accommodation with the Sunni majority as something that was going to lead to their destruction. So it was, it became this very rigid, hardline approach.
We're seeing this kind of complicated situation play out in Turkey right now.
That's right. That's right. And what the complicated, so
we have two Sunni fundamentalists at loggerheads, former
right.
allies.
So, and what you have again and again in these countries is you have all these internal schisms and or points of friction, but also these regional players coming in. And you mentioned Turkey. Over the course of this project, I interviewed close to two dozen ISIS members who had been captured either in Kurdistan or in Iraq. And over half of them had crossed across the Syrian-Turkish border. And they all said, yeah, we saw guards, we saw soldiers, they just waved us through. So Turkey's played a really dirty game in a lot of this.
Were the captured ISIS soldiers still true believers?
No.
Because we keep on hearing about people being disillusioned, but there still are thousands and thousands
right.
of people who are fighting for ISIS right now.
Most of the people I interviewed were the foot soldiers. They were the grunts. And what I was amazed by again and again was they did not join out of any religious fervor. And they weren't radicalized in mosques. They joined because their buddies did. And because, you know, tend to be kind of poor or working class young men with virtually no future. And there's much more. And at that level of ISIS, they have much more akin to, say, why somebody would join an inner-city gang or why a kid in Mexico would join a narco gang. It's the allure of living big for 2 or 3 years and then dying badly. But somehow that equation sounds better.
Why people join join other countries' forces, often the military, for the excitement, the adventure.
That's right. That's right.
We mentioned the Kurds earlier. You tell the story of General Heso Mirkan and his son Azar. Wasn't the CIA supplying weaponry to him and his Kurdish fighters?
Yes. Back in 1975, when, of course, the Shah of Iran was still in power. Iran and Iraq were having a kind of a border war, and the Kurds in Iraq were fighting against the central government of Iraq, so they were kind of our proxies, and so we were giving them CIA weapons. And then overnight, Iran and Iraq patched things up. Saddam Hussein and the Shah made a peace treaty. The CIA, under Kissinger's orders, cut off all supplies to the Kurds, and the Iraqi army swept into Kurdistan, slaughtering everybody in their path. The subject, one of the six people in my story, Azar, he was actually born. They call it the Great Betrayal. It was on March 6th of 1975. He was born on March 7th. He was born on the road as his family fled towards the Iranian border.
But he's called the lucky one.
He's called the lucky, right. It's somewhat ironically, because Kurdish luck is bad luck.
Yeah, you say they must be the unluckiest of all people, spread across the mountainous regions of four nations, Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. They've always regarded themselves as culturally apart from their neighbors and have constantly battled for independence from those nations they inhabit. Maybe the reason that Turkey has look the other way when people cross over for ISIS is because they see ISIS is fighting Kurds and they're involved in
absolutely
a constant war against Kurds.
That's absolutely it. There's another whole aspect to Turkish relations in the region.
We also meet Khalud al-Zaidi, who had a relatively comfortable middle-class childhood in Iraq in Kut. She's 23 years old, so she was quite young when Saddam was toppled by the American invasion. She's mostly known civil war during her short life.
Yeah. Khalud's an amazing woman. She was from a traditional Shia family in a provincial city in Iraq when the Americans came in, and was very much seduced by this talk of the Americans that they were going to build a new democracy. It was all about women's rights. And so she signed on. She worked for the Coalition Provisional Authority, the American installed government. And then when the Americans receded and the power began to recede very quickly, she tried to continue doing these projects for women's emancipation, and became targeted by the militias and ended up getting part of her family out to Jordan. She was death threatened out, and she ended up spending the next 11, 12 years just stuck in Jordan. And just this last, it's funny because I've been writing about Kulod for this project for a long time. And just a few months ago, she got on a boat to Greece. And so now she's in Austria, she and one of her sisters.
In your epilogue, you write, after 60 months of traveling in the Middle East, I find it impossible to predict what might happen next. But I get the feeling that it would be very easy to predict that things are just going to get worse.
Yes, you're right. I can see that infamous phrase, light at the end of the tunnel, which I think was first used for Vietnam. I can see something positive going forward in, the next few years in Iraq. Syria, no. I think Syria is going to burn for the next 10, 15 years. And Libya is going to get worse now because Libya, along with the Balkanization of the country, it's also going to run out of money next year.
Is Iraq going to get worse partly because of the Russian intervention?
You mean Syria?
Syria.
Yeah.
Now we have Yemen where the Saudis have bombed a hospital and killed a bunch of children. That's another flashpoint that's largely being ignored.
Yeah, no, that's true. No, Yemen has been largely ignored. I think that it's... again, the problem you have in Syria is, again, with all the internal stuff, but it's all the outside players. It's Russia, it's Turkey, it's us, it's the Saudis, it's the Qataris. Everybody, this has become everybody's football.
When we announce that we have taken a lot of territory back from ISIS and we have killed a number of their leaders, does that really matter? Is ISIS here to stay, or some equivalent?
Yes. One of the other subjects I write about is this young Syrian college student. He said, the problem with ISIS now is it's not just an organization; it's an idea. And yes, I think you can destroy the physical embodiment of ISIS right now, but that idea is going to continue on.
Scott Anderson's series of articles, "Fractured Lands: How the Arab World Came Apart," made up the complete Sunday New York Times Magazine, and I'm so pleased that you were able to come here to talk about it.
Well, it was my pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.